Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. In general, it is difficult for children to report how they are doing in school and at home. This is why I feel we need to stop continually asking them about these things. If we are patient, attentive, and observant, the information will be revealed through their play behaviors if we're doing play therapy, or through the stories they tell us about peers and others during talk therapy. If we continue to ask kids constantly in therapy how they are doing and how things are going, we can accidentally develop a rapport such that we ask a question and they answer with something like, fine or good, no matter what it is we are asking. At times, it is really hard as a mental health therapist not to ask directly, because usually we are meeting a child who is suffering, and so there is urgency to understand the issue and resolve it as quickly as possible. So let me be clear. We do need to assess things such as safety concerns, capacities, functioning at home and at school, and treatment progress, among others. What I am suggesting is that there are additional ways to understand things beyond direct questions. In the last episode, I explained that Anna Freud's straightforward method of assessment for children's progress in therapy is if they are developing to typical norms for their age. There is a variety of ways to do this, and I reviewed the child development stages of Erik Erikson's 8-stage model because that is the one that is the easiest for me to remember. And in this episode and upcoming ones, I'll provide some ways to use this model in the assessment of children. Let's start with stage one. As a reminder, stage one runs from 0 to 18 months, and the conflict to be resolved is trust versus mistrust. You may be wondering how mental health therapy can support children at this stage, and you would be right to wonder this. In the way I work, I would not work independently with children in the first two stages, but instead I would do sessions with caregivers included. Unless the child has developmental delays, the concerns in this age range are usually attachment and unpredictable mood swings. A couple of things about our human physiology is that we are not fully able to function without our caregivers up through the first years of life. Infants need adults to hold them, to support them in regulating their heartbeat and breathing rates, for example. Additionally, verbal skills may be attained, but the ability to reflect on one's thoughts and feelings comes in later stages. And even symbolic play, that is the ability to take an object and pretend like it is part of a larger play scene, does not come on until about 2.5 years. So independent play and talk therapy do not work at these stages, and the therapy that does work that I've seen is to support the attachment between the child and their caregivers. I struggled with starting with stage one for these follow-on episodes after I introduced the Erikson model because this first one is difficult to see how it works. But I'm going to go ahead and explain this stage, and then hopefully the way it more specifically works will be illustrated as we talk about later stages. And since what we're doing here is about assessment and not the actual interventions, I'm going to continue the conversation with how the model supports that assessment by highlighting a couple important elements of stage one and why it is important to look for them and assess what you see. So the Erickson stage here is about trust and mistrust. So what do we do with that? Well, for me, this is mainly the consideration of whether or not the child has an environment they can trust and how therapy can increase that trusting bond with caregivers. The child doesn't know, per se, in the sense that we think of as cognitively making the decision to trust or mistrust their environment. But it's, in a way, to me, how I think about it is the trust versus mistrust is a foundation that later cognitive skills are built on. And so their thinking kind of rests on the foundation of, if the world isn't mostly safe and mostly consistent, and here we can borrow from Winnicott's idea of good enough, then everything is kind of fluid. And it's really hard to build logic and cognitive processes for the next stage and beyond, because nothing makes sense consistently. Like, things kind of are upside down one day and then right side up the next. So to me, that's how I conceptualize mistrust from a child's perspective. And unfortunately, if someone does not have a trusting environment for this stage, we are not likely to see them in therapy. Typically, caregivers bring children into therapy at this age because they are concerned for them. And that means, sort of by default, that they are in an environment that can be trusted to provide for their needs. The way I use the model is to mark time for the child I am supporting. In other words, what do I ideally want to see in terms of development at this age? And do I see it? And how will I know what signals the next stage? A lot of what can be seen in this stage is highly dependent on what the child is capable of doing. So it helps to know about how the human body typically develops and then be able to make some extensions of how that affects their relationships with their caregivers. Here's a couple examples. At age 3 months, infants start to be able to see at a distance of a few feet. And this is usually the time reciprocal facial expressions start to develop. So the child is looking on its caregiver, seeing their eyes and maybe a smile, and returns similar eye contact and smiles from a distance of a few feet. As we know from any age, mutual gazes can be really fun. This is part of knowing that I'm looking at you, looking at me, and you are looking at me, looking at you. And now this happens while apart. In other words, the child can have this experience without being held. So in the trust versus mistrust perspective, we are looking to see if the child can trust that its caregiver will be looking to reciprocate their eye contact and smiles. If they don't appear to have the anticipation that their caregiver will meet their gaze, that is going slightly away from the trust side of this stage. Again, we're not usually going to see it veer all the way into mistrust, otherwise you would not have the opportunity to be meeting with this child. Yet, if it's not happening consistently on the trust side of things, that's something we can support through therapy that focuses on attachment. Also, as a side note here, it's part of our due diligence as mental health therapists to ensure the family has resources to check in with other specialists, such as primary care physicians and maybe infant toddler programs where they can assess the child's abilities. It is really impressive how quickly our peers in the medical and occupational and physical therapy and even other types of development specialists can figure out and help a child get on task for things like rolling over and walking and other capabilities. And in order for them to support children, the physical tasks need to be consistently checked. Things like hearing and sight and the major ones need to have regular observation, and there can be lots of good things happen for children if something is maybe off track and gets caught early enough, it can be addressed quickly. Another typical behavior that tends to happen a while after this, for some children it may be up to a year after, but all kids experience it, and that is the experience of stranger anxiety. Essentially, children become afraid of newcomers or even people they have met but maybe don't see daily. They develop a really strong preference only for immediate caregivers, and they have a lot of anxiety and fear of strangers. To me, it's actually a neat feature of human development because it coincides with us learning how to crawl and walk pretty far away from caregivers. The way I was taught to conceptualize this is along the lines of, kids just learned how to move pretty far from their caregivers, so the fear is related to this newfound capacity, and it actually serves to support safety and by extension survival by bringing them back on their own when they get concerned. It's kind of a built-in feature that the anxiety brings them closer to their immediate caregivers. They will grow out of it in time, and from a therapy standpoint, I've found it to be important to endorse these survival instincts. In this case, you know, it's common for a child to be scared to meet their therapist on the first therapy session and maybe even the first view. It's a healthy response to a stranger, and I like to endorse these instincts. We also need to take another side note here and start referencing how trauma affects development, and this stage is a good area to discuss it. Many researchers confirm this to be true, and that is that trauma stunts or slows down development, and you can really see it with children, especially in these young ages. Vander Kolk reviews some of the research done in his book, The Body Keeps the Score, which I just looked up, and this coming year will be the 10-year anniversary of that book. And Cozzolino explains how the process works in the brain in his book, The Neuroscience of Psychotherapy, Healing the Social Brain, which just had its fourth revision out this year in 2024. I will share one example of how trauma affects development here to illustrate how this works and how Erickson's model helps me know where to assess the concern and start designing interventions. Clinically, I use the stages to provide me a ballpark of time. For example, I remember in my mind that the stranger anxiety typically happens during stage one. And let me tell you what happens when there is a lot of trauma or other unexpected events for the child. And that is that sadly, children who are in the foster care system or for some reason have had multiple homes and are raised in multiple environments with multiple primary caregivers will actually exhibit a near complete reversal of this stranger anxiety instinct. The working theory is that is because they have to adjust to many caregivers, and so their natural instincts to be wary are kind of overridden because they have to adjust to live in what are called multiple rearing environments. In other words, they're raised in multiple households. And so that's one way that the trauma affects the development of this particular behavior, and it kind of stunts it. And so then what tends to happen is that this interest in meeting strangers, like I say, it's a reversal of the stranger anxiety instinct. And so then we see children at later stages who are way too easily acquainted with adults. And it signals to me that something may be happening that I need to learn more about. In our culture, it's often seen as cute when a child, quote, doesn't know a stranger. And it can be. But it can also be extreme, which signals that the child could be seeking support outside of the immediate family for some reason. And so it needs to be assessed. And I can start narrowing to possibilities because of this model. So what happens is the stranger anxiety behavior is common for children in stage one. And the conflict of stage one is trust versus mistrust. So I see something happen at a later stage that ties directly back to stage one. And it helps me kind of narrow in on where to focus because now I can think about the fact that maybe something happened in that earlier stage that affected the trust versus mistrust concept that I can support in therapy. So it helps me like narrow to possibilities because trauma stunts that growth in terms of the stages. It prevents the successful resolution of them. So I might start asking the caregivers more about the child's experiences during stage one and if there was trauma at that around that age or what was happening. Often at these ages, the child may have experienced multiple caregiving environments, either through the foster care system or some other reason. And it isn't to say, though, that everything relates to trauma and there may be other reasons this is happening. But this is how the model helps me highlight the behavior, assess why it is a concern from a child behavior standpoint, and then target interventions, particularly to support that behavior in being resolved. And it's mainly when things are at the extremes that I'm curious because there's so many wide varieties of the ways children develop. But hopefully this gives you an idea of how it works. For next time, we will be discussing stage two, and one of the major milestones there is toilet training. And so when I hear caregivers start to provide examples of behaviors around this, I know the child is moving into the next stage of physical development, and this cues me to be alert for the associated psychological growth, which I will discuss in the next episode. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.